Even as the war loomed, Japan was Australia's friend. Japan bought huge quantities of our wool, coal and iron. For years, wool barons, businessmen and politicians worked at the Japan-Australia Society to promote understanding and cooperation between the two countries. Japanese, thousands of them, were welcome to live in White Australia. On the brink of war, we were still shipping coal and iron north. So it's no surprise that after Pearl Harbor, it was widely assumed that a fifth column of prominent Australians had been working on behalf of Japan for years, and that before the war, authorities had stood by while Japanese in Australia spied on behalf of their country. Nick Horden, former diplomat and former senior writer at the Financial Review, has examined those fears and the agencies that investigated them in his new book, Loyalty: Australians, Japanese and Espionage on the Eve of the Pacific War. And Nick joins me now. Nick, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks very much.
Nick, that these people may have been working for Japan is in a sense a reasonable deduction from the way they lived and traded in the 1930s, isn't it?
I would say not. I think what happened was that the entire Australian establishment, whether it was official or whether it was business, realised that Japan was very much a growing power and that their only option was to work with it. Certainly there was a powerful business lobby that very much appreciated the bilateral trade and were very much of the opinion that the government should do everything in its power to foster it. Just as these days there is a commercial lobby that argues that Australia should maintain good relations with certain Asian countries because of the importance of the bilateral trade.
You'd be saying China, wouldn't you?
Maybe.
Yes. But at the same time in Australia, there was in many places an understanding that if Japan became aggressive, we would probably be on our own.
Yes. Even in the mid-30s, this was becoming increasingly apparent as the Depression had kind of hollowed out British military strength on which we relied. So the Minister for External, George Peers, said in the mid-30s there was no policy open to Australia other than trying to be friendly to Japan and give her no excuse to adopt an aggressive policy vis-a-vis the Commonwealth. Now, by mid-1940, with the fall of France and the Nazi conquest of Western Europe, that argument became overpoweringly strong. The Australian government realised that it was quite unlikely that the British could fulfil their promise to guarantee Australia's security, and therefore they adopted every measure to avert Japanese aggression, and for this they were accused of appeasement.
It's quite an extended passage in your book that really surprised me. So in September 1940, Japan joined up with Germany and Italy in the Axis. It became officially an Axis member. That is in September 1940. And in January-March 1941, a Japanese major, Major Hashida, was allowed to tour Australia quite openly, quite frankly, looking at our beaches, our military installations, etc., etc. How could that have been allowed?
Oh, quite simply because at that stage, Canberra was desperately trying to cultivate good relations with Tokyo and avoid giving any offence whatsoever. So as the situation deteriorated in Asia, one of the first things they did was to launch a diplomatic initiative and exchange ambassadors with Tokyo. This was quite unprecedented. They had, before, the British had always handled our bilateral relationship. Now Canberra and Tokyo agreed to exchange ambassadors. Our first ambassador to Tokyo, Sir John Latham, arrived there in December 1940. Hashida arrived in Australia without our knowledge 2 weeks later. The last thing they were going to do was to cause a diplomatic incident when Latham was attempting to establish his footing in Tokyo by booting Hashida out, which is what the army would have dearly loved to have done.
Tell us what Hashida did in Australia. It's just extraordinary.
Basically, he carried out a two-month reconnaissance of the coastline. He circumnavigated the country from Brisbane round to Darwin, sometimes by sea, sometimes by road, but mainly by air. And he collected a vast harvest of open source intelligence. What that means is that he went around and collected information which was in the public domain. He went to bookshops and he bought roadmaps. He took photographs. He asked all the Japanese business community what they could tell him about Australia and the way people did business. What he did not do, or what he has never been proved of doing, was actually carrying out espionage, which someone has described as secretly trying to find out other people's secrets.
It was all, as we call it, open source material.
Yes.
But so Hashida is going around the country at a time when Australians are getting more and more scared of what Japan might have up its sleeve. And the other thing that's wonderful focus in your book is the Japanese habit of noting things down in little books.
Well, this goes back a century. At the time of the Meiji Restoration, which was this tremendous national project of national regeneration and essentially catch up with the West, the watchword in Japan was that they had to find out everything about the West, not just about military technology, not just how to make steel or rifles or wireless or how to organise your army, but absolutely everything. How Western societies work, how they were ordered, not necessarily because they wanted to copy them, but because they wanted to an indication of what was the best way to go ahead. If you want the finest battleships in the world, then you have to have naval engineers, and those naval engineers have to be trained at the best universities available, and alongside them are the best metallurgists in the world working on the material to make these battleships. So that was the impetus. As a very close-knit and patriotic people, the word went out, note everything you can, and they did.
And Australians became aware of this, and also aware that they carried cameras and took photographs of things. Who were the people who, in the 1930s, were alert to and worried about this activity of the Japanese?
Well, there are a number of points to make here. One is that suspicion of the Japanese as Asiatics, as coloured people, went back generations. It went back to the 1880s and 1890s, and in fact the Immigration Act of 1901, the Federation era legislation, was explicitly aimed at excluding Asiatics, or Asians. So that's point number one. There was a long legacy of racial suspicion and hostility. This was slightly mitigated by the fact that during World War I, they're actually our allies during World War I.
Yes.
But by the 1920s, as Japanese militarism started to develop and then basically exploded into China in the 1930s, all the old suspicions came back, and this time they were reinforced by indications of Japanese technical prowess, right?
Yeah.
So, basically everyone, suspicion of the Japanese was widespread across the political spectrum, but it was particularly strong on the left for this reason, that in terms of Marx's class doctrine, Japan was regarded as a nascent capitalist power, which was joining up the international capitalist conspiracy, including in imperialist and exploitative ways. And the invasion of China is regarded as a textbook example of this. But it wasn't just the left. Many on the right were also very much alive to the threat of Japanese militarism.
But the Japanese had established themselves in Australia. We couldn't keep them out. We needed them.
That's it. Your last point is right. We needed them. Initially, we needed them because they were essential to running the highly lucrative pearling industry. That was in the first two, three decades of the century. But mainly, it was the commercial presence in the eastern capitals who are buying all this wool. Incidentally, in your introduction, you said we were exporting iron to Japan. As a matter, we weren't. And it was actually the fact that we refused to export iron ore to the Japanese that basically incensed the Japanese and gave them essentially a major grievance against Japan. We did export pig iron, hence Robert Menzies' nickname, Pig Iron Bob, but we did not export iron ore, and they very much wanted us to.
I stand corrected, but it made Bob Menzies determined that those shiploads of pig iron go north.
Yes.
So that While on the one hand there is this friendliness towards Japan, on the other there is suspicion as well. So it's a kind of a fraught friendship that is going on here. Were Japanese in Australia being investigated, being surveilled, kept an eye on in the years before the war began?
Certainly in the years before the Pacific War began, the answer is yes. Contrary to some popular perceptions, the Australian security intelligence apparatus in the late 30s and early 40s was very well resourced and it was very active. I don't know how you prove this, but I think Australians were probably, by 1942, they're under closer surveillance than they had been at any time prior to 9/11. And the current national security state. So it was omnipresent. There was a whole raft of organisations, military and some civilian, who were keeping tabs on people. Now, of course, their main targets were the Germans and people of German descent, of whom there were many. And next cab off the rank were Italians, of whom there were many. And so obviously with the outbreak of the war in Europe, these two communities became prime targets for surveillance. But the Japanese were a special case. One, because they were right next door. They're actually in a capacity, as it were, to invade us. And two, because there were so few of them, it was easy to maintain a basically, total surveillance of them. And this is why when the Pacific War broke out, they actually managed to intern all of them. So there was never a policy of wholesale internment of Germans or of Italians, essentially because there were too many of them. But by 1942, they basically interned everyone Japanese, and that was very loosely defined.
So that the people who were keeping an eye on the Japanese were doing so for this additional purpose, were they not? That they, unlike the Italians and Germans, they represented a racial threat.
Oh, very definitely. No. Very, very definitely. That was the added dimension. It's not that they were the authorities were, thought that the Germans and Italians were nice people who'd just gone a bit wrong. It wasn't like that at all. But definitely, the racial dimension was a major factor in the approach towards the Japanese, and particularly when it came to the case of women. Australian women who were married to or were the partners of Japanese. This was regarded not just as a national or a racial betrayal, but actually a sexual betrayal as well.
A most intimate betrayal. Mm. When were the Japanese interned in the war and where were they interned?
Basically starting immediately on December the 8th, 1941. The authorities had already identified every Japanese in the country. They had been issued with blank warrants for their internment, and basically they got cracking straight away within 6 or 7 hours of Pearl Harbor. Basically what happened was that in the metropolitan centres, like in Sydney, for example, they had an interim holding camp at Holsworthy, but very quickly they were shipped way inland. And eventually there was a string of internment camps all the way up and down the Murray Valley from New South Wales and Victoria into South Australia. And bear in mind, these were only civilian internees. Alongside this, there were the POWs. So these were Italians and Germans captured in the Middle East, and later on they were Japanese captured in Asia. They were a completely separate category. But I think at its peak in mid-1942, there were something like 12,000 civilian internees in Australia, and a good portion of them were what you would call these days Australian citizens.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Nick Horden about his book, Loyalty, Australians, Japanese and Espionage on the Eve of the Pacific War. Nick, let's talk about the afterlife of these fears and allegations of what Australians themselves and the Japanese had been up to. Because after the war, the allegations that there was this sort of high capitalist fifth column emerges as an important political issue in Australia.
That's true. In fact, it emerges as an important political issue worldwide. Throughout the Western Alliance, the perception that the Axis powers had powerful allies within, the enemy within, was widely accepted. For example, the dramatic Nazi conquest of Western Europe was for a long time attributed to a fifth column, which is actually a 1930s term. It was coined by during the Spanish Civil War. It was commonly accepted that basically the Nazis in Europe and, for that matter, the Japanese in Asia had achieved their success basically because there was a whole raft of traitors waiting to open the door for them. And so it was reasoned by commentators on the left in Australia that if this had happened everywhere else, it must have happened or been going to happen in Australia. So there were grumbles even at the time, as early as 1941 and 1942, that capitalists and conservatives had been way too close to the Japanese business establishment. But after World War II, these allegations took on a kind of retrospective hue, as it were, culminating, of course, in Rupert Lockwood's 1953 Document J.
Well, before we get to Document J, the question has to be asked, could there have been truth in this? I mean, there was a section of the Australian community who had a deep commercial interest in remaining friendly with Japan, trading with Japan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And their loyalties could well have been deeply divided or indeed on the Japanese side. I mean, this was a question worth investigating, was it not?
It certainly was. There is abundant evidence that there were senior Australian businessmen and politicians who argued that there were very strong commercial and diplomatic advantages to be had from maintaining a good relationship with the Japanese. That's unquestionably true. The point is that there's absolutely no evidence that any of them carried out any activity could be regarded as treason at all. In fact, the only people in World War II Australia who were actually proved to be treason were, of course, the Soviet agents who by 1943 were congregating in Doc Evatt's office. Right. Now, but here's another thing. We've been talking about how it's all about capitalists and conservatives. There was another Australian politician, very prominent, who in the early months of 1941 was striving to have a good relationship with Japanese diplomats. In fact, he was conducting back-channel negotiations with them. In fact, he was actually offering them access to Australian iron ore. And his name was John Curtin. And in October 1941, he became Prime Minister of Australia. Now, you never hear people accusing him of being a Japanese collaborator.
No, you don't. But you do read in John Edwards' splendid biography of Curtin details of this.
Oh, yeah. It's no secret. No, it's added to his credit. If you go on his website, they're saying, you know, the expressed wish, if only there'd been more people of, you know, goodwill and foresight who would have done this.
We might have avoided trouble.
Yeah. But so, in other words, if you're Sir Henry X, then it's a sign that you might be a traitor. If you're John Curtin, it's a sign that you're a peacemaker.
Nick, you've been through all the evidence. Is there any material that you can't get at? Is the material now all in the public domain?
Okay, so now when one is talking about the surveillance records of certain individuals, I have come across redacted passages. I can't at the top of my head remember who they were, but these were mainly to do with surveillance of communists and suspected communists in the 1950s.
Now, explain who Rupert Lockwood was and Document J, because this was to be a sort of a nuclear explosion in Australian politics in the 1950s.
Rupert Lockwood is probably the author of the most authoritative recension of the great Japanese collaborator conspiracy theory. So very smart young journalist, came up in the 1930s. He was radicalised. He went to Spain, where he reported on the civil war from the Republican side. Initially, he was working for the Murdoch press. fell out with them, came to Sydney, and by late 1939, he had become a clandestine member of the Communist Party. And he was he was a good writer, he was a charismatic public speaker, and he was a good organiser. And very quickly he became one of the CPA's leading operatives, as it were, or public operatives in Sydney. Then the CPA was banned by regulation by the Menzies government in June, I think, 1940. But because his membership was not declared, he was able to keep on operating, which he did.
As a journalist?
As a journalist. He wrote undercover for the Tribune, which was the CPA underground newspaper. And he also wrote for other publications in ways, and he made speeches at public meetings, which basically advanced the communist line without crossing over into territory that would have seen him rendered liable to internment. Now, he kept on going. The CPA, eventually the ban on it was lifted in late 42, and he became a long-time writer for the Tribune. In 1945, he began to very aggressively push the line that there were all these rich titled capitalists who actually had collaborated with the Japanese.
And it was time to expose them.
Exactly. It was time for restitution on that part. And this went on. And, of course, it culminated, as we all know, in Document J, which he wrote in the Soviet embassy in Canberra in 1953. And it's an alarming document, 37 pages of it, famously described as a farrago of facts, filth, and
Fiction.
Thank you.
Facts, filth, and fiction. Who called it that? Was it
Windia? Who was the government counsel for the commission on the government side?
Yep.
So in it, in Document J, Lockwood rehearsed all this stuff that he had heard, all this conjecture about high-placed Australian Japanese collaborators. And the very interesting thing was that when he was asked where he got all this information, he actually stated, and by the way, the source of most of this material was my old school friend, Kenneth Easton Cook.
Okay, now let's just pause for a second. Now, it gets the title Document J from the Petroff Royal Commission, right?
That's right.
And Windia, who you mentioned, who went on to be a very distinguished High Court judge, was representing the government, and farrago of filth, etc. And so we are in the cockpit of the great Communist Party hunt of the Petroff Royal Commission. Now, Lockwood is admitting the source. Tell us about his school friend who was said to be the source of all of this material.
Kenneth Easton Cook was born in 1912 and he died in 1986. He was basically a fabulist and a fraud. That's my judgment. I say this because he gave various accounts of his life at various times, which have been completely contradicted by the record in the archives. Now, I want to make a point here quite clearly. As Nadia Wheatley recently made the point vis-a-vis her biography of Charmian Clift, that because the archives are continually being, more and more archival material is being released and more of it is being digitised, it is now possible to go back and check statements that were made in the past against this newly available material. And that is a capacity which was not available before, right?
And this is what you've been doing.
Yes. So the official record is now enabling us to verify or discount statements that were made in the past. But Easton Cook was basically, he was a charlatan. And he did talk his way into a position with Australian counterintelligence from February 1939 down to about December 1940. But as soon as the authorities became aware of just what a shonky was, they branded him as unreliable and just severed connections with him. Okay, his main claim to fame, one of his claims to fame is that he managed to avoid military service during World War II altogether. And one of the ways he did this was by, for years, by telling everyone that he was actually a secret agent in the on the books of the Australian counterintelligence establishment, whereas in fact he'd long since stopped.
Now, Nick.
Yep.
Okay, so this is the cast of communists, fabulists, the Petrovs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a fascinating, absolutely gripping, fascinating story. I've been down into those rabbit warrens, and they are wonderful. But Nick, what does it mean now? What does it tell us of continuing importance in this country that we became so wrapped up in these fears, these allegations, which you are essentially arguing, I believe, were all groundless?
Okay, groundless is probably too strong. What I am saying is there's no evidence.
Yep.
There's no evidence.
Okay, I appreciate the distinction. It's a very important distinction.
Okay, right. Okay, so I think the message for today is twofold. One is the whole debate hinges on this grey area between espionage, secretly trying to find out other people's secrets, and OSINT, open source intelligence material. Now, at the time, in 1941, the authorities were beating their heads against a wall because there was no law against collecting open source intelligence. If you went to the Harbour Bridge and you walked over and said it's X yards long, and you went and told your Japanese friend that, there was no law against it.
Quite right.
Right? Okay, well, now there is. There's recently been an amendment to the Crimes Act called Reckless Foreign Interference in operation in Australia. And what this means is that if you provide even so-called innocuous open source material to an official of a foreign government, and you are reckless of whether that information that you pass on could harm Australia, irrespective of whether it's classified or not, then you can be charged, tried, and convicted. And in fact, that's just happened in Sydney. It has actually happened in Sydney. It's a case. You can go and see if you just Google reckless foreign interference. It's there, and I'm not going to comment on the case, but it's a real thing. And, I mean, this is happening all around the world. For example, in Putin's Russia, no surprises, a guy there got 16 years because he went into a bookshop, bought a book about Soviet-era nuclear bunkers, came out, and gave it to an American. He's now doing 16 years in Siberia.
Nick, so, do you support that?
No.
That's completely crazy, isn't it? You can buy a book. I mean, the American could have gone into the bookshop himself and bought the book.
Well, that's correct. But I think I'm not advocating one course or other here. What I'm saying is that I think the purpose behind the new Australian legislation is that there's a realisation that people can act in detriment to the national interest without actually breaching, let's say, the Official Secrets Act. I'm not sure of the legalities of it, but it is definitely a step up. You see, during World War II, there was this guy, John Sleeman, who was a research assistant for the Japanese consulate, and he used to carry out these research projects into all kinds of unclassified stuff, like, for example, charcoal production, because at that stage charcoal was a strategic commodity.
So this was when?
Cuts.
During the war?
No, 1941, on the eve of the Pacific
War. Eve of the war.
And so the police said, right, he's got to stop this because he's helping the Japanese. And at that time, Doc Evatt said, no, if he's broken a law, we'll charge him and we'll try him. But until you can show that he's broken the law, we can't do anything about it. Now, of course, at the outbreak of hostilities, Sleeman was the very first Australian to get locked up. And he was interned, and he stayed interned for a long while. But he was never charged, he was never tried, because he'd never broken any law. So that's the kind of gap.
Okay, so now we've got a law that says if you tell a foreign power the length of the Harbour Bridge by pacing it out, you could end up in jail. Nick, a broader reflection.
Yep.
Is what happened then mirrored now in this country's political suspicion of members of, governments of, agents of other races?
Absolutely. All this decade we've lived under the shadow of the Great China Scare thing. Now, I'm not an analyst. I have no knowledge of classified information. I do not know what the military balance is. But what I do know is there are people running around saying we will be at war with China very soon, including the Herald. According to the Herald, we're meant to be at war with China right now, according to their prediction of 5 years ago. Okay? The other thing, of course, is that as these fears, justified or not, of China grow, then so suspicion of people of Chinese origin will grow exponentially. And moreover, Australians of European origin who are associated with Australians of Chinese origin or indeed of Chinese citizens. So we had that recently, a federal parliamentarian basically accused her political opponent of having Chinese, quote, Chinese agents on its staff.
So we see it again.
Yeah, well, it's never gone away. And the important point about all this, I am not saying there are no external threats to Australia. What I'm saying is that when you get a perception of external threats to Australia, then all this other stuff, the fear of the enemy within, the envy of certain elites, indeed the naked self-interest of certain commercial interests, all these things come into play and they see basically become amplify the whole conversation.
Nick, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Well, thank you very much indeed.
I've been talking to Nick Horden, whose book, Loyalty, Australians, Japanese and Espionage on the Eve of the Pacific War, is available now. It's published by Australian Scholarly Publishing. This is Late Night Live.